Ready to proceed?
May it please the court. It is the plaintiff's position, the appellant's position, that the trial court made two mistakes in this case. The first mistake was placing an improper limit on the application of the collateral source rule. And the second mistake was failing to grant a new trial where a jury award was contrary to the undisputed expert medical testimony on the issue of causation. With respect to the collateral source rule, this court held in Farrell versus Gordon that a court cannot limit or dilute the force of the collateral source rule absent express legislative direction. In this case, the trial court limited the application of the collateral source rule in medical malpractice cases in the absence of express legislative direction. The legislator talked about or expressed its intent regarding the collateral source rule when it enacted 18 Del Code 6862. In 18 Del Code 6862, the legislature specifically indicated that there is proper to place a limitation on the collateral source rule in medical malpractice cases, but restricted the application or the limitation of the collateral source rule only where the collateral source derives from a public fund. And that interpretation was affirmed by this court or acknowledged by this court in Manico Combs versus Uday.
Let me interrupt you for a moment just to make sure I understand the master fact. There was a bill for medical services that totaled some $50,000. Is that correct?
There were actual bills that totaled approximately
$57,000. And that amount was negotiated down to $37,000, correct?
Correct.
The insurance company paid the $37,000.
Correct.
And at the trial, the plaintiff was permitted to put before the jury the $37,000, which had been paid for by the insurer.
Correct.
To that extent, the collateral source rule was invoked and it applied correctly.
Correct.
So the only issue is the extent of the reach of the collateral source rule, isn't it?
Yes.
Not whether a limitation was placed on it.
No, a limitation was placed on it. The limitation placed...
Well, assuming your conclusion, that is that the collateral source rule requires that the jury hear evidence of what was billed, whether or not that amount was paid by the insurer, and whether or not the patient was liable for that amount.
Correct.
And there's no question here that Mr. Mitchell was never liable for the $20,000, isn't that correct?
That's correct.
Now, on your first argument, let's assume you prevail. And are you advancing this as a law of the case argument in the event you prevail on the second issue, so that if there's another trial, you get to introduce the $57,000? Or are you contending that the ruling somehow constitutes reversible error in and of itself?
I think the argument can be made both ways. Obviously, I'm going to make the argument that it constitutes reversible error. Does a mistake like this mean that the plaintiff failed to receive a fair trial? I think in
the the reason I ask that is, given the magnitude or lack of magnitude of this verdict, tell us what the difference would have made if you had 57 rather than 37, because the jury came in a lot lower than anything related to either one. So I can see if you had a new trial because you went on issue number two, you'd want to put in the 57 the next time. So let's focus on why it would be reversible error to put in 37 rather than 57. And if you don't want to do that, we'll just go to the second issue.
The jury wasn't told the full extent of the damages. And in a case where the jury award was only $13,000, it seems to me that when you deprive the jury of the knowledge that there were an additional $20,000 worth of medical expenses, which is more than the actual award, it seems to me that depriving the jury of that knowledge is depriving the plaintiff of a fair trial. And by depriving the plaintiff of a fair trial, I think that would be the type of mistake that would warrant a new trial. And I think, Justice Jacobs, to answer your question, I think when you ask a question like that, what you're focusing on is the relationship between the plaintiff and his insurance company. And I think Justice Holland, in the dissent in State Farm versus Nalbone, and he cited the Yarrington case in support of this proposition, specifically said that you don't focus on the relationship between the plaintiff and his insurance company or the collateral source. The only focus should be placed on the relationship between the plaintiff and the tortfeasor, because the issue is, if the collateral source doesn't derive from a fund provided by the tortfeasor, then it shouldn't be considered at all.
So the plaintiff could say to the doctor, look, bill me $57,000, bill me $157,000. We both know the insurance company is not going to pay that much, but I can blackboard that to a jury.
That can be done, but that's not what was done in this case. What was done in this case is there was an actual bill generated by the healthcare providers, and that actual bill was $57,000. And but for the fact that the plaintiff went out and purchased a private source of insurance coverage, the plaintiff would have been obligated to pay that $57,000.
Well, I just thought you told me that the plaintiff would not have been required to do
that. The only reason the plaintiff was not required to pay the full $57,000 bill is because he had purchased insurance with an insurance company that had an agreement with the healthcare providers. Absent the fact that the plaintiff purchased that insurance, he would have been responsible for the full $57,000.
We don't know that, do we?
I think we do know that. There's no
reason. Testimony in the record that if this particular plaintiff did not have insurance, the doctor would have billed the same amount?
The bill was $50,000. There is an exhibit. It was a trial exhibit. What I was not permitted to introduce into evidence, that established that the actual bills submitted by the health care providers were $57,000.
But the health care provider knew that there was insurance coverage.
I don't know if that's true or not. I mean, I suspect that somewhere on the form the plaintiff indicated he had health care insurance, but I don't think the provider billed $57,000.
I'm asking on what basis we could conclude that this $20,000 is a real number.
There were actual bills. That is what the doctors, the health care...
Well, I know there were actual... There was a bill that was sent out, and we know that bill was not paid, at least to the tune of $20,000. We know the reason for that is that there was an agreement between the healthcare provider and the insurance company. What we don't know, because the record doesn't indicate, is whether if there were no insurance, that Mr. Mitchell would have been liable for the full $50,000. There are many cases where physicians, knowing that they're dealing with uninsured patients, will submit a lesser bill. That's at least a possibility.
The only thing I can say is that's not in the record either. The only thing that is in the record is the presence of actual bills that total $57,000. And I think the issue is, the only reason that there was a reduction in those bills is because the plaintiff purchased insurance. And what the trial court was faced with was providing a windfall to either the plaintiff or the defendant. And under the collateral source rule, that windfall should go to the plaintiff, not the defendant. In this case, the windfall went to the defendant. And because 6862 is specifically silent on a limitation on the collateral source rule with respect to private sources of funds, that limitation violated the rule that this court announced in Farrell versus Gordon. And for that reason, the trial court should be reversed.
Well, on the second issue, the way I read the judge's ruling, you're contending that the medical testimony was not contradicted, and therefore the jury's verdict was clearly inadequate in light of that testimony. But the argument seems to be, and the judge's analysis seems to be, even though the medical testimony was not contradicted and there was a causal connection between what happened and injury, there wasn't a sufficient connection in the record between the bills and the injury. And therefore, the jury could have just decided that in the absence of a concrete connection between the bills and the injury, you know, what they awarded was correct.
And my position is the trial court's analysis was wrong because there was a specific connection between the bills and the injury. There was specific testimony, that expert medical testimony, and my position is that causation, issues of medical causation, have to be based upon expert medical testimony. That was this court's holding in the Christian, the ruling case, and I think that's this court's holding in Davis versus Moore. So the question is factually, was there undisputed testimony? And there was. Dr. Lin testified that as a result of the medical negligence, the plaintiff's appendix was allowed to perforate. Dr. Rogers, who was the only doctor who testified concerning causation, then testified that that perforation caused four very distinct injuries. And he also testified that because of the existence of those four very distinct injuries, the plaintiff required hospitalization on four different occasions. And the evidence established that the medical bills for those four hospitalizations totaled in excess of $32,000. So despite what the trial court said, there was expert medical testimony that established the cause of the injury, it established the nature of the injury, and it also established the cost required to treat those four distinct injuries.
Now when you say 32,000, is that 32 out of 37 or 32 out of 57?
32 out of 37. Because the four hospital, I'm wrong, it probably would be 32 out of 57. I use the actual bills. Because the four hospitals, the bills for the four hospitalizations totaled a little bit, I think it was $32,293. And those were the actual bills.
Well, and that's where I'm trying to follow your argument and the judge's reasoning, because if we just say 80% of the bills and we go with the figures you put in, clearly the bills that you could connect to the four events are less than 37, and you put in 37, and the jury said, all right, well, they've only connected, they didn't connect them all, maybe we have some concerns on whether they properly connected the rest. And that seemed to influence the judge's thinking.
It's hard to tell because the judge actually held that the jury award could have been upheld even if they awarded no medical bills. And to me, that has to be wrong because the jury couldn't find that none of the medical expenses were compensable no matter how you analyze the case, because there were these four hospitalizations. And even if you did make all the discounts you want to make, those four hospitalizations, the bills for those four hospitalizations, would have totaled more than $13,000. And the only reason the jury didn't know exactly what those four bills were is because the court's ruling on the first issue prevented me from putting in the actual bills.
I saw that in the record, that when you decided on the 37, things weren't itemized, they were put in the aggregate. So in other words, it said, here's what happened medically, here's the total.
And it was the only way that it could be done, and it was done by stipulation during the trial. And maybe that's the answer to your question during my first argument. Why did the court's rule on the collateral source rule create the type of error that would require a new trial? And that may be the reason, because had the entire bills been put into evidence, the jury would have been able to see very specifically what bills were attributable to those four hospitalizations, and then would have become very clear that those four hospitalizations cost $32,000, and the jury couldn't possibly have concluded that a jury verdict of $13,000 was appropriate in this case.
Mr. Esmond, you're in your rebuttal time. Did you want to save it?
Yes. Thank you.
The main damage issue at this trial was the plaintiff's attempt to relate a lot of subsequent medical difficulties that he had to the fact that his appendix ruptured. And that was in significant dispute throughout the trial. All of these medical expenses that were in issue and all of the pain and suffering that the plaintiff was claiming were related to things that were not clearly related in any respect to the injury. And the problem with the plaintiff's case, as the trial judge articulated, was that the plaintiff presented no evidence from any treating physician, presented no evidence as to what treatment was going to be required in any event, because it's obvious that this patient had a disease that was going to require surgery and hospitalization in any event. But the plaintiff never presented any evidence to the effect that if this had been diagnosed 2 days earlier, the medical expenses related to it would have been X, but because it was diagnosed later, the medical expenses were Y, and because it was diagnosed late, these subsequent things happened. All they did was bring in Dr. Rogers, who's a disability doctor, who performed a brief medical examination, who found basically nothing wrong with Mr. Mitchell that can't be explained by his unrelated disabilities. And he offered some testimony that attempted to link up all of this subsequent treatment. The subsequent treatment was for a pulmonary embolism that developed 3 months after the events in issue. And he tried to argue that...
3 months after the emergency appendicitis?
Correct. He tried to argue that, well, because he had surgery and was off his feet, that put him at risk for a pulmonary embolism, and he never really explained that Mr. Mitchell would have had surgery and been off his feet anyhow, and he didn't establish how his immobility or disability would have been different from the surgery he would have had to have had in any event versus the surgery he did have. The other hospitalization is one for a hernia, and it's undisputed the hernia operation would not have occurred but for an unrelated umbilical hernia that Mr. Mitchell had. He also had an incisional hernia. Dr. Rogers tried to link that up with the failure to diagnose appendicitis by saying, well, he had an incision, and that's related to the incisional hernia. But the fact is, he would have had an incision no matter when the operation was performed, and nobody said he couldn't develop an incisional hernia if the operation had been performed 2 days earlier. So, in any event, there's all this subsequent disability. Well, I'm talking too fast. Mr. Mitchell developed a pulmonary embolism when he had his day surgery, which basically refuted Dr. Rogers' contention that the earlier pulmonary embolism was related to his supposed prolonged immobility related to his appendix surgery. And he couldn't really explain that. A lot of Mr. Mitchell's claim was that he had pulmonary problems. He was treated by a pulmonologist for emphysema because he'd been smoking cigarettes for 44 years. But he tried to claim that his pulmonary disability was somehow related to the appendicitis because he developed a pulmonary embolism 3 months after the events in issue. The trial judge did what this court said a trial judge is supposed to do in Story versus Camper, whether you're granting a new trial or denying a new trial, and that is analyze the evidence, give deference to the jury findings, and articulate the basis for either for the court's action, either denying or granting the new trial. In this case, the trial judge analyzed the evidence at considerable length and explained why the plaintiff's claims that all these subsequent developments were somehow related to the failure to diagnose appendicitis 2 days earlier than it was, were not not necessarily credible and why the jury did not have to accept them. Mr. Roseman, in his brief, does not really challenge that articulation other than to say, I presented evidence that hooks it up, and therefore I should be entitled to all these damages. And that's not the law, and I've cited the decision in the Dunn case, which was decided by this panel, that differentiates that kind of case where causation is not conclusive, where it's not clear what caused what, from the cases relied on by Mr. Roseman, where it is conclusive.
Well, what's your position on the collateral source argument? Assume hypothetically that the full 57 should have come in, but it didn't. Tell us why it doesn't make any difference.
Well, my first response is that the court doesn't need to address it. Mr. Roseman, although he was a little ambiguous in responding to Your Honor's inquiry about this, has urged that the court reverse the decision of the trial court because of the failure to allow him to introduce the additional $20,000 in medical expenses. It's absolutely obvious from the amount of the jury verdict that the jury ignored or discounted most, if not all, of these subsequent medical expenses. And the trial judge articulated why the jury could have done that and why it was acceptable. And if this court accepts that, then the extra $20,000 makes absolutely no difference to the disposition of the case, and the court doesn't have to decide this issue.
So then it really turns on what you said earlier. In your view, the plaintiff had undermined the credibility of his own case by stretching these connections to subsequent events that had nothing to do with the appendectomy, and in undermining his own credibility, the jury viewed the medical expenses the same way.
Well, Your Honor just said exactly what I said in my closing statement in this case, and that's certainly the way I viewed it, and I think the way the trial court viewed it in denying the motion for a new trial. But to address the substance of the collateral source issue, I've cited the Pennsylvania Supreme Court decision, which cites other decisions which are in accord. But the basic question I would ask is, what public policy would be furthered by allowing Mr. Roseman to do what he wanted to do in this case, which is introduce an extra $20,000 in damages that nobody paid?
Well, but as you know, the Pennsylvania case was a Medicaid case, and that seems to be distinguishable. And other states have said, if we're going to have a collateral source rule, we don't distinguish between tortfeasors, whether it's a car or medical malpractice. And in this case, the judge seemed to say, well, I'm going to carve out an exception for medical malpractice tortfeasors as opposed to tortfeasors driving an automobile. Help us, you know, decide why that people who commit medical negligence should be treated differently than people who commit other acts of negligence.
Well, I don't know. I don't accept totally Your Honor's characterization that the trial judge carved out an exception for medical malpractice cases. I think she was troubled by the decisions in the auto accident cases, but said that in this context of a medical malpractice claim, I'm not going to follow those cases. That we may be just mincing words about that, but my position is that the medical malpractice statute, 18 Delaware.
I was just going to ask, and I need this as a matter of education, if this were an automobile accident case, would the additional $20,000 have gone in before the jury?
Well, I can articulate reasons why it can be treated differently, but I would make the same argument that I make in this case, is what public policy is furthered in this era of managed care, which did not exist when Yerington versus Thornburg was decided, what public policy is being furthered by making any tortfeasor pay something that the injured plaintiff never had to pay, had no obligation to pay, and that doesn't have to pay back?
Right. And my question, however, is there a situation like this that has arisen in the automobile accident context, that is, a bill that was not paid in its entirety by the insurance company, and for which the tortfeasor was not liable, and yet was presented to the jury?
Mr. Roseman has cited two unreported cases, one from the Superior Court and one from the District Court, where they ruled in his favor on it. They adopted basically the position that he was urging in this case. And I know there are some other trial court rulings that are to the contrary.
But well, it may be time, or there may come a time when it's revisited, but as I understand the theory behind the collateral source rule, if we assume the doctor's bill for $100 was a real $100, that if there was no insurance company involved and the doctor said, you owe me $100, then the question becomes, if you have insurance and the insurance has negotiated a contract and you get paid 80%, so that even though the real bill is 100, the doctor's paid 80%, agrees to pay 80%, nobody pays the $20 differential. In these particular situations, the way the collateral source rule operates, you put in $100 anyway on the theory that the tortfeasor shouldn't get the advantage of this independently negotiated discount.
Well, that's the argument in favor of doing that, and my question is, what public policy does that further in the context of the medical environment that now exists, which did not exist at the time of Yerington versus Thornburg? At the time of Yerington versus Thornburg, bills were paid in full. Oftentimes, the insurance companies had liens and would be able to recover that back, so it was only fair that it be applied in that way. In this day and age, many years later, most bills are not paid in full. And in this medical malpractice context, you're in effect penalizing the healthcare provider for providing discounts to medical bills to keep costs in check. And the ultimate effect of that, arguably, is, if you were to adopt this position, is to just drive costs up.
Yeah, when the healthcare provider's not getting penalized, it's the tortfeasor. But I understood your earlier
answer. Well, the healthcare provider in this case is the tortfeasor.
Well, exactly.
The doctor.
But we're talking about innocent healthcare providers who are providing hospitalization as opposed to the tortfeasor who, if the jury thinks they committed negligence, is in a different situation. But my question to you, because I understood your earlier answer, are you saying things have changed such that the collateral source rule should be changed uniformly for all tortfeasors, or that in this particular case we should recognize there's been enough change since Yerington that at least as with regard to medical negligence there should be a different rule?
Well, I don't think Yerington even indirectly addressed the issue that this case presents, and the Pennsylvania Supreme Court said the collateral source rule applies to the payments actually made, because we conclude that is the reasonable value that is the benchmark for damages. So you don't have to change the collateral source rule. You simply have to apply it to a circumstance that didn't exist when Yerington was articulated.
Mr. Roseman points out that to the extent this is a legislative prerogative, that the legislature has spoken in 6862 of Title 18, by limiting the collateral source rule only when the source of payments from a public fund. Does that suggest to you, and therefore should it suggest to us, that the legislature has not taken the empirical evidence, had committee hearings, made the determinations that you urge upon us, and modified public policy by statute that would allow us to readdress the existing collateral source rule?
Well, my position is that the original collateral source rule, which is a judicial creation, did not address this situation, because this situation didn't exist when it was originally articulated, nor did it exist when 6862 was enacted in 1976, I think. I would argue that that legislative provision represents a legislative intent to control damages in a medical malpractice context. It doesn't change the collateral source rule in terms of what's recoverable. It merely says that the jury can be told that X amount of medical bills have been paid by Medicare, for instance. So I'm simply asking the court, well, I'm not asking the court, I'm saying that if you get to this issue, which I contend you don't have to get to, if you get to this issue, you don't have to change the collateral source rule. You have to look at the reason the collateral source rule was originally articulated by this court, what objectives, what fairness it was seeking to accomplish, and then apply that to this situation, which was not contemplated by the court back then, and determine what is most fair. Is it most fair to allow Mr. Mitchell to get a $20,000 bonus because that's what it would be, or is it most fair to limit the admissible damages to what has actually been paid?
I understand your point about that, and I would candidly say to you, this is falls into the arena of a court, appellate court, making legislative fact-finding about what exists out in the world and what the social ramifications are of changing the collateral source rule or not in light of the changes since, whether it's the case you cited or 1972 or any other year. And do we have the kind of record before us that would allow us to pontificate in the style of the United States Supreme Court, as they so often do, after pages and pages of amici curiae briefs from every interested party in the nation, or if not the world, to determine what the state of morality and social life ought to be on this planet? I wonder if this one little medical malpractice case has developed the kind of record that would allow us to go down the path that you've suggested. Those of us who had recent medical bills understand completely what you're talking about if we have a health care provider. But those are legislative facts, I think, as the law reviews refer to them. And it would be very difficult for the panel of three of us to accomplish what you wish accomplished on this record, don't you think, Mr. Turner?
Well, that question involves so many things I could go off on. I'm not going to take you up on it. But I would agree with that. This record does not present you with the best opportunity to visit this issue if you ever want to visit. I don't think you should visit it for the reasons I've told you. I don't believe if you did visit it, you have to view it as attempting to change the collateral source rule, but simply adapting the collateral source rule to change the circumstances in the 50 years since it was originally articulated.
One other thing before your time runs out. Mr. Roseman suggested if he had been allowed to introduce the full medical bills as he wished to introduce them, that the jury's opportunity to look at those bills would have helped him articulate the way in which the injuries his plaintiffs suffered and the bills for the treatment of those injuries would have related to the appendicitis and not be confused with what you referred to as subsequent unrelated problems, pulmonary or otherwise. Would the mere presence of these bills and the purposes for which the accounting reflected the services that were provided, would that have helped the plaintiff explain the nexus between the alleged malpractice and the injury suffered?
Absolutely not. And I would... If Mr. Roseman thinks it would help him to submit to the court these bills so that you can make your own judgment, I have no objection to that. But the bills don't say anything other than amounts and dates. And Mr. Roseman argued, apparently unsuccessfully, that these amounts were incurred in September of 2001 because he had a pulmonary embolism and it shouldn't have happened. This amount was occurred in February 2004 because he had a hernia operation. We contend that's related, and on and on. But I have no objection to him giving you the bills and letting you form your own conclusion about that. But my answer is no, it doesn't add anything.
Going back to the collateral source rule, I gather what you're saying is that this is a judge-made rule, therefore it can be changed judicially or at least reinterpreted in light of new facts. Assuming that we can take some sort of judicial notice of the changed healthcare insurance environment, give us some guidance as to how we should evaluate the fairness or unfairness of allowing unpaid, that is billed but unpaid amounts, to be presented to the jury under what I would call an expanded collateral source rule doctrine.
Well, if Mr. Mitchell had unpaid bills of $20,000 that he was liable for, I would agree that under the collateral source rule, he would be entitled to admit them. I would urge the court to adopt the reasoning of the Pennsylvania court, which says the reasonable amount, the amount that's admissible, is the amount that's paid in the context where there is no liability of anyone to pay any higher amount beyond what goes in evidence, as was the case here.
Thank you, Mr. Kern.
Thank you.
Mr. Turner argued to the jury, and he argued to this court, that the pulmonary embolism was unrelated to the perforated appendix, that the hernia was unrelated to the perforated appendix. The problem with the argument is it was entirely unsupported by expert medical testimony. If that argument was the appropriate argument, he could have called medical experts that would have supported it. He did not. The jury never heard one expert witness to support any argument that you just heard made by Mr. Turner. There is no reference in the trial court's decision, there is no reference in the record to any expert medical testimony to support any argument that Mr. Turner just made. The only record evidence, the only expert testimony presented to the jury was that the pulmonary embolism was caused by the medical negligence, that the hernia was caused by the medical negligence, that the adhesions were caused by the medical negligence, and that the medical treatment that the plaintiff received was made necessary by those specific injuries. The jury disregarded that expert medical testimony despite the fact that there was no contrary expert medical testimony presented by Mr. Turner, and that was a choice he made, not to present expert medical testimony to support the arguments he wanted to make. And I'm going to ask this court not to adopt Mr. Turner's arguments very simply because they're not supported by anything in the record.
Well, by analogy, where do we go with that? In workman's compensation cases, we've said if there is a dispute, the jury can assess the credibility of the experts. Well, let's suppose here where you have only one expert, but the jury questions that one expert's credibility. Are you suggesting the jury can't question the expert's credibility?
I think, as this court said in ruling, and as this court said in Davis, that on issues of medical causation, those issues must be decided based upon expert medical testimony. And the only exception to that, and I'm not sure the Dunn case can be read as an exception to that, would be where there are no objective findings to support the expert's opinion. In this case, there were objective findings to support his opinions. These were real injuries. These were not soft tissue injuries that are based upon a plaintiff telling a doctor that they exist. These were actual injuries, and the only medical testimony established that those actual injuries were caused by the medical negligence. And that's the difference between this case and the Dunn case.
We usually hear that argument when there's been a verdict for the plaintiff with zero damages. In this case, there were damages. How would you address, again, the nexus argument? How did the jury logically parse this out?
That's why I focused only on the medical expenses, because failure to award all the medical expenses is the equivalent of awarding zero damages. It's the same thing. The jury was presented with unrebutted evidence establishing that the plaintiff incurred medical expenses in excess of the award returned by the jury. That, to me, is identical to a jury disregarding the evidence of medical testimony, as was done in Davis, and awarding a zero verdict. It's the same thing. And that was why I focused on the medical expenses, because it just seems to me that where a plaintiff presents unrebutted testimony establishing medical expenses in excess of the jury verdict, that jury verdict is necessarily incorrect and should be reversed.
Thank you, Mr. Roseman. Thank you, counsel, for an intriguing argument. We'll take the case under advisement.